Welcome to On the Couch, a podcast from Reaction with me, Lucy Beresford, broadcaster and psychotherapist, taking a deep dive into the relationships, psychology and personalities making the headlines in politics today. In this week's bonus episode, I want to analyse whether there is something about Westminster that makes it such a hotbed of scandal and risk, and whether working in Westminster attracts damaged people, or does it damage them? Since he entered number 10 in the late summer of 2019, Boris Johnson's premiership has been punctuated by a string of scandals. From Wallpapergate, Partygate, even Treehousegate, there is also a stench of sleaze, from affairs and watching porn at work, to sexual harassment, jail for sexual assault, and rape. From Reaction, I'm Lucy Beresford, and for this episode of On the Couch, to explore whether there's something very specific about the culture at Westminster that nurtures such egregious behaviour, I'm delighted to welcome broadcast journalist and founding member of Sky News, Adam Bolton. Hi, Adam.
Hello.
Welcome to my couch.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here, although I should say I'm sort of a bit of a surrogate here. I've been living with MPs and covering politics at Westminster for nearly 40 years, but I'm not actually one of them.
Well, sometimes when you're in it, you can't see the wood for the trees, and it's much better to have an observer commenting on it, which is frankly, after all, mostly what my work involves. And that's right, you have been watching Westminster for decades now. And that list that I read out there at the beginning, that in a way only covers the last couple of years. And it would be shocking in any kind of organisation, in your experience and what you've observed, how typical is that behaviour in Westminster?
I think Westminster is a peculiar place because you've got more than 600 people, over 1,000 if you include the Lords, grouped together in a professional endeavour, but pretty much on equal terms. Once you're an MP, you're the same. So in Westminster, one of the key things to remember is that there isn't really a career hierarchy of people managing behaviour. And I think that has the consequence, if you like, that everyone feels that they're as good as everyone else. So because they're all MPs or parliamentarians, that they are entitled to a certain type of behaviour. And they're not really disciplined. I mean, although we've been talking, obviously, with Chris Pincher about the whip structure, an MP is self-employed, an MP chooses their own staff, and ultimately, they're only accountable to their electorate every 4 or 5 years. There isn't that employment structure for the people working for them that there would be, or the protections that there would be in other environments. So in that sense, it is already a bit of a peculiar bear pit. And of course, you're talking about a high concentration of professional people, if you like, people who already have some sense of their own status and self-regard built on the fact that they have been endorsed by the electorate.
Well, that's really interesting, because when I analyse the personality traits of people who seek high office, they are often very long on things like risk-taking, competitiveness, one might say narcissism. And as you say, you do have to have a certain amount of chutzpah, don't you, to say to thousands of people, maybe even hundreds of thousands of people, I am amazing, vote for me. So what is it about Westminster then that actually attracts those people who perhaps exhibit it in an even more extreme form, like you said, that entitlement, whose behaviour looks entitled, and then they end up being convicted of rape or sexual assault, or at the very least, unwanted sexual advances?
Well, there is that old joke that politics is Hollywood for ugly people. And certainly by becoming an MP, you can acquire a certain amount of celebrity and public respect fairly quickly just by that one factor being elected. On the other hand, I think one of the things we often overlook about politicians who perhaps are seen as ugly people, fairly grey, people inclined to wear suits, fairly boring, is they're all gamblers, they're all risk takers. I mean, most people, including myself, we try and build a career, we get qualifications, we get experience, and we can more or less say, I'm going to climb up this particular ladder over the course of a working lifetime. Politicians are not like that, because every 5 years or every 4 years, there's an election. They throw it all in the air. They could lose there. And even if they're in a safe seat, or what is generally called a safe seat, your chance of preferment, of climbing up the greasy pole, becoming a minister, let alone become a prime minister, are very slight. First of all, your party has to be in government, which most of the time it's not going to be, just statistically, if you include the Liberal Democrats and the others. Secondly, you have to be in the right clique to have a chance of preferment from the prime minister and his colleagues. And thirdly, even if you qualify in that area, you might not have the right profile to get a job where, which you feel you do very well, because they might be looking, I don't know, they might be looking for women, they might be looking for people from ethnic minorities, they might be looking for people with a different sort of background to what you've got. So actually, you're gambling all the way through on your professional ladder. And that, I think, is unusual. It's not something which most quotes professionals or indeed most people in, you know, blue collar jobs actually do.
Well, it's so interesting you talked about it in the form of gambling, because my theory is that politics in general is very addictive, especially if you work in it. It creates that very bounded space for people who are longing to prove themselves, either maybe to themselves or maybe in some kind of deeper Freudian way, you know, to their parents or something, and to prove that they're worth something. And maybe people who've got very big but very fragile egos. And as you say, you've got all those people working together, maybe, in my view, all trying to heal those early childhood wounds. But it can also be very humiliating. As you say, you might get kicked out of office. You might, you know, not win the next election. So you've always got to keep proving. You've got to keep winning. You've got to keep sparring. In that sense, then, because it might be addictive, because it has got that gambler's throw of the dice, could you see that working in politics in a way brings out the worst in people?
Oh, yes, I certainly think so. I mean, let's take the current situation. You know, the question I ask myself is why on earth aren't more ministers resigning? You know, on the basis that to every palpable public perception, the prime minister has been caught out. Half the party no longer have confidence in him. And it is only going to end unhappily, as Enoch Powell always said. So why would you cling on to being the junior minister for paperclips at this particular point?
My dream.
And the answer is, I think, partly that politics becomes a game because you've got 600 people all basically competing in the same thing. Once you get a foothold, you don't particularly want to give it up. But I agree with you that I think what happens is that tends to divorce you from your roots. You're just playing this game and trying to win within this game, and you're not seeing how it looks to the outside world. The other point, of course, is that the material gains, most of these ministers have a very slight. Yes, they're being paid a bit more, but they're also having to work 7 days a week and be on call and have very long hours. And on a daily basis, they're being asked to do the soul-destroying thing of going out in public and supporting things that they think are wrong. I mean, for me, that's the problem with party politics and the whole whip system anyway, that you have collective responsibility and you have to support things that are wrong. I mean, you know, by and large, if you're working for a company and you think what it is doing is wrong, you don't go on working for that company unless you think you can change it. Whereas, you know, once you say, OK, I'm going to accept party discipline in order to be able to further my career, you are constantly being asked to say something wrong. And you know, one of the things that Boris Johnson has done is that in terms of getting people to go out and lie on his behalf, he's parodying a system which is already there within collective responsibility. And, you know, normally you go out and you say, you know, I may feel on this policy that we haven't got it quite right, but that's what my party has decided, so I'm going to support it. In this case, it's, I may feel Boris Johnson is a bounder and a liar, but because he's our leader, I've got to go out and support him in public. And I think, you know, that is very difficult. And certainly what we've seen over the last few days is even people who have achieved relatively high rank, like Rishi Sunak and Sajid Javid, just can't do it anymore.
And that presumably is because politics, to use a slightly different analogy, is a bit like cricket, which is that it's both a team sport, but it's also an individual sport. You know, if you're in cricket, you're part of a team, but at some point you're the only batsman facing the ball. And similarly in politics, you're trying to collectively do something together, but at the same time, you want it to be about you or having your bill go through the Commons, or you want to make your mark. And so you're constantly having to navigate what's in the best interest of me and what's in the best interest of my constituents and what's in the best interest of the party. And how do you keep all those plates spinning in your head at once?
Yeah, I think the difference with cricket, well, there are lots of them, but one obvious difference, is that in this case of cricket, the captain is the sole selector. And therefore, your relationship towards the captain and the power that the head of the executive is granted is much greater than in professional team sport, where, you know, yes, you've got a manager, but you've also got a selection board and other people overseeing it. You know, it's perfectly possible to have a team playing where you know that there is deep antipathy between the members and the captain may not like the people playing on this side. I mean, Mrs. Thatcher and the Wets is one example. But what Boris Johnson has done is he said, no, that doesn't apply. I've got the power to choose who I want, and I will only have people around me who are loyal to me.
Well, we saw how successful it was for England yesterday against India, having changed the captain to Ben Stokes. So I wonder if the Conservative Party will take note from that. But let's stick with Boris Johnson for a moment. I believe that there, a group called Conservative Staffers for Change wrote to Boris only a couple of months ago to get him to stop treating claims of sexual abuse and harassment as mere gossip. So do you think this culture, particularly with regard to sleaze, have things got worse under Boris Johnson? Or is it actually more that, you know, things like the Me Too movement have made people feel more compelled to speak out? It's just, we're just not tolerating things that, for example, when I used to work in an investment banking, this is pretty much what it was like the whole time. And we all just assumed that that was okay. And now we know that it is all right to stand up against it.
Well, first thing one has to remember is the culture changes. So that, for example, in the decades I've been covering politics, it has become acceptable to be a gay MP. It didn't used to be. I mean, it's only within my lifetime that both Labour, my working lifetime, that both Labour and Conservative MPs have actually been prepared to come out in the public and say that they are gay. And of course, if you go back to the 1960s, you couldn't possibly admit that you were gay because it was actually against the law. And similarly, for a very long time in politics, as in polite society, there was a barrier against people who got divorced. Really, it was only with the arrival of Margaret Thatcher that we had a large number of divorces taking place in cabinet level. So mores do change over time. And ultimately, when people are forced to resign or whatever, it's because that they have, you know, cross the barrier as to what is culturally acceptable at a time. And I think we have to accept, whether we like it or not, that socially there have been changing attitudes towards sexual harassment. You know, if we think back away from politics, you know, the sort of things that were considered amusing in Benny Hill or Dick Emery or whatever, generally acceptable, would not be regarded as acceptable today. And, you know, one of the issues is that, I mean, I do remember actually with Labour politicians talking about research assistants who come over from American colleges in the summer. And someone said, oh, I think he's sleeping with his American intern. And another MP who subsequently became a minister said, well, that's what they're there for. And you know, I mean, this was 20 years ago, but all I'm saying is attitudes kind of shift over time. And one of the things I think that's gone wrong is that MPs in that particular area, the power dynamic, which we've already discussed to a certain extent, have been slow to recognise that. I mean, similarly, you know, we only have to look at the number of women MPs and it's at record levels now. But again, you know, back in Margaret Thatcher's day in the 1980s, women were a very small minority in Parliament. There were certain sexist attitudes which were prevalent. And indeed, certain sexist attitudes which some women MPs played up to quite deliberately and quite flirtatiously. So there are changes there. However, to come to the immediate crisis, the kind of run of sleaze, I feel that it is given license by the personality of the Prime Minister, that because the Prime Minister himself has had an extremely colourful private life, if we can put it that way, and because he has consistently brushed that aside, allowed his reputation as a bit of a rake to feed into his personality and been prepared to make excuses or excuse it on many occasions, I think it's only inevitable that his followers start to think that the same applies to him. You know, he's made it clear that he is a libertine when it comes to sexual behaviour, and he doesn't feel that it's something that should be held against a prime minister. So why particularly should it be held against an MP? I mean, this remark, which he's not denied about saying about Chris Pincher, Pincher by name and Pincher by nature. I mean, it is very believable that Boris Johnson might have said that, and that might have been his attitude.
Mm. Well, let's turn to that Chris Pincher drama, because, of course, the interesting thing about it is that it does predate Boris Johnson being Prime Minister. And given that so many people did know who he was and what he was like, that he was, I think someone once described him as a pound shop Harvey Weinstein, which is just, on so many levels, a ghastly image. What is it about Westminster? Not just, you know, not just the culture from the top now that Boris Johnson is there, but before that, when Theresa May was in charge, she brought Chris Pincher back. What is it about Westminster that indulges rather than curbs that behaviour? Is it the lack of a rigorous HR structure such as you might have out in, you know, in other industries? Or is it just simply about turning a blind eye?
I think a bit of both. I mean, I've got to say, personally, perhaps it's a fault of mine. I'd never heard of Chris Pincher till this happened. So I don't, you know, he was a sort of, and a whip, so very much insider figures within party politics rather than extroverts. And he was only a minister for Europe for a very, very, very brief period. I think the reason is that for political leaders, convenience in terms of who they promote is more important than anything else. And at the time in which Theresa May appointed Chris Pincher, she was vainly, as it turned out, trying to appease the Eurosceptic right of the Conservative Party. So she promoted someone who very much identified with that wing of the party and indeed was recognised as an organiser of that wing of the party. In Boris Johnson's case, the reason why he promoted Chris Pincher was that, as I say, he likes to surround himself with loyalists, people who've worked for him, people who will try and shore up his position, irrespective of their merits as people or their merits as administrators. And I think, you know, in Theresa May's case, you can say, I think had she known the full picture of Chris Pincher, I think it's very unlikely that she would have promoted him.
So you think she didn't know?
She didn't know the full. But nonetheless, at the time that she promoted him, I don't think she probably liked him or had much respect for him, other than as his position in the party that she was trying to appease. I think in Boris Johnson's case, he knew full well what the jokes were, the words and the allegations against Chris Pincher were, but he thought that they were amusing or trivial compared to what Chris Pincher could do for him, having been one of those who organised support for him when he's come under pressure within the party. To come back to your question, yes, I do think it's a problem that there isn't a proper HR structure within Parliament. You know, as I said before, MPs are their own employers and they're all equals, and they jealously regard that freedom, although sometimes some of them question it. So, for example, you know, if you're in Parliament, you're not subject to the same licensing laws that you are in Westminster. MPs can decide what they're going to do or not going to do about the historic building in which they work, even though it's clearly a danger to public safety. And likewise, they employ their own staff and they pretty much set their own terms and conditions. Now, A, that's clearly a recipe for bullying and abuse. They would say, well, of course, you know, we've got to have a structure. I mean, if I was reforming Parliament, I would say every single person who works for an MP, including MPs, should be deemed to be an employee of the Palace of Westminster, and that there should be proper HR procedures in place to manage that and to give people rights. I think it's perfectly possible to do that. That's how it works, for example, in the United States, you know, which has not been immune from some of these scandals. But ultimately, a congressman or a senator can appoint their staff, but that member of staff then becomes an employee on the same pay structure and everything else as the employees of the other congressman. And so therefore you have those protections. We don't have those protections at the moment, and that's how we've got the abuses of MPs employing their wives or employing their children who don't actually do any work. And of course it should be properly regulated. And you know, these sort of Spanish practices, which are often hurled by conservatives at the trade unions, these sort of Spanish practices used to go on in businesses and other employment workplaces, but now they're not acceptable. And everyone, you know, certainly me, you might moan quite a lot about HR and compliance and all the rest of it, but nonetheless, it puts guardrails in which simply aren't there in Westminster. And therefore, so you've got these risk-taking people playing typically for relatively small stakes who, you know, feel that it's, you know, it's up to them. And it's very easy in those circumstances to start tolerating aspects of your own behavior, which looked at from outside would be deemed unacceptable.
It's interesting you should mention just now the building and how unsafe it is, because without that rigorous HR structure, the whole workplace feels unsafe. And that's why I often think there is such chaotic behaviour as people try to almost self-medicate to try to deal with the fact that their lives, their working lives, have that element of risk, to it, that element of danger that isn't protected. And on that note, Chris Pincher's own resignation letter, when it was citing alcohol for playing its part, although obviously in my view, that's only an explanation, it is not an excuse for his behaviour. And obviously in my world, alcohol is a prop, you know, it's a maladaptive coping strategy for other issues. And it is a form of abuse. There's abuse throughout the system. But what's your view of the part played by this drinking culture, this other dimension to Westminster in particular, which is that it's got these subsidised bars and that it's got, you know, large numbers of people hanging around? You know, the ministers are probably very, very, very busy all the time, but the spads and the, you know, other people on the fringes, they're hanging around waiting for things to happen. So what are they going to do? They're probably going to meet and drink and chew the fat, and then it starts to become a problem.
Well, I think this goes back to opportunity to a certain extent. I mean, groups of people socializing and getting drunk is, you know, unfortunately a part of the British character, as far as we can tell. It does happen elsewhere. One only has to go out in the streets of any major city on a Thursday or a Friday night and see, you know, let alone hen parties and stag parties and all the rest of it. You know, I live in central London, and believe you me, drunkenness is constantly around us.
And
I
mean, other industries as well, like in investment banking, in medicine, lots of people work hard, but they play hard.
I think we might recognise that as a social problem. I don't think that's particular to MPs.
Yeah.
What Peter Bottomley, for example, the father of the House, the Conservative MP, who's been there at least as long as me, says is that there is increased temptation. He says that Two things have happened. One is that MPs have far more assistants and staff than they used to. So they're, and they tend to be young people. So there are lots of, you know, fairly attractive, ambitious young people hanging around Parliament. And he says that didn't used to happen. Secondly, he says, and I think this is clear, that there has been a kind of routinization of lobbying and entertainment provided by interest groups that within the rules offer hospitality, drinks, parties and things to MPs, not just at Westminster, but at party conferences and elsewhere. So there's much more temptation, both in terms of drink and flesh, for people to abuse it, and that's his argument. I'm not sure I fully accept it, but he thinks that has changed. And you know, the other thing we have to remember is that there has been this professionalization of being an MP, so that if you go back to the 60s, many MPs had a day job of one kind or another and then came into Parliament in the evening to do parliamentary business. And so there was actually less hanging around. Now, one of the paradoxes is that the view that being an MP should be a professional occupation and the discouragement of people having second incomes or second jobs means that even although they've tried to move towards more social hours, individual MPs are expected to spend more time just hanging around in the precincts than they used to. And as you say, these precincts are ones that weren't really built for that density of constant human occupation that the Palace of Westminster now undergoes.
What's your view of this line that often gets trotted out, that Conservative scandals are usually about sex, which obviously the Chris Pincher one predominantly is, whereas Labour scandals are more about money?
Well, I think in a sense, when we're talking about scandals, we're talking about transgressive behaviour. And I think the right of politics has tended to be more moralistic, more censoring of personal behaviour, so that it's going to be more of a scandal, if you like, if someone is caught violating that set of values. And similarly, the left probably, well, certainly provenly in recent times, more liberal as far as sexual mores is concerned, much more sensitive to money. And you know, whereas the cabinet, the Conservative cabinet, is stuffed with millionaires, being a rich person on the left is a cause of suspicion. And so if you are seen in one way or another on the left to be money grabbing or taking risks in order to enrich yourself, that is violating their set of mores in a different way. And that also leads to scandal. I also think, you know, difficult to put it this way, but Tory MPs are probably going to find it a bit more desperate to satisfy their sexual needs because they're more likely to live in a conventional style, yeah? Whereas it's going to be harder for someone on the left to be rich and make a lot of money. You see what I mean? I think it's about what you violate. The sort of slap and tickle and mistresses and getting people pregnant and all that, I mean, that is always conceived in the popular mind. It's not necessarily the truth, but it's conceived in the popular mind as a power dynamic. That is where I think that, you know, the Conservative sense of, you know, entitlement is indulged. And because it's indulged, it's more like to boil over in that area. I mean, you know, I don't want to go into it, no point naming individuals, but you know, it's certainly true that there have been sex scandals on the left and in the Liberal Party as well. So, you know, it's not unique to the Conservatives.
So it's more about our reaction to it. As you say, you know, the expenses scandal being a classic example, yeah, because that was across all parties. Nobody sort of zoned in just on the Labour MPs.
Yeah, I mean, take for example, take homosexuality, you know, which I've already said has changed. But, you know, at the time of Section 28, if you were a Tory and you're backing Section 28 and you were gay, you were a hypocrite.
Yeah.
If you were...
And there were some.
And there were some who were exposed. If you were Labour and you were opposing Section 28, so what? You see what I mean?
So ultimately, we've explored all sorts of angles to this, which is because it is such a topic at the moment. But I suppose sexual assault and the power dynamics are things that we look at in many institutions, and we would disapprove of it, whether it happened in the church, the judiciary, financial services, and that hornet's nest, as you say, could take place in many other sections of society. But Westminster is that particular bubble, that particular hotbed. So my final question to you is, do you think that Westminster, and maybe politics more widely, does it actually attract damaged people, or does it ultimately damage them?
I suspect both, but I think it does more damage than attract damaged people. I mean, there's been a lot of research into this to show that people who reach the top in politics, for example, disproportionately seem to lose a parent at the early stage of their life, and therefore they're, you know, supposedly looking for some other structure, family structure, to accommodate them. And you know, this has only been gradual, but I feel now that it is a kind of snake that's eating its tail, is I think that the environment of Westminster is now corrupting. And I think that's for a whole load of reasons. I think it's partly because of the physical reasons. It's partly because the level of media scrutiny, which there's been, which to a large extent has been to try to put it right, has actually discouraged quite a lot of people of quality from going into politics, not because they're necessarily up to a bad thing, but they just think, for that level of return, it's not worth subjecting me and my family to that level of scrutiny. So I do think there's been a slightly inferior deterioration of the quality of people going to Westminster. But at the moment, I feel that the whole power dynamic of promotion and entitlement and status, which MPs are scrabbling for, is, you know, we're back to power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And I think we have seen a move which has happened over certainly the last decade or so towards the executive, politicians and members of the executive trying to be less accountable. And I think that has increased the level of corruption, you know, which is taking place. And you know, you can almost look at some of the politicians that we have towards the top of the chain today and sort of almost see a rake's progress in terms of, you know, the corruption which they've undergone. And this is not a problem which is unique to the UK, although I think the UK, after America, is probably in one of the worst states on this at the moment. And I do think unless we have politicians coming forward who are prepared to take the hard decisions to reform, which probably means finding a different location, certainly changing employment structures, probably means getting rid of the patronage system, which we haven't talked about, to do with the House of Lords and the honours and all the rest of it. If we don't do that, I think we probably are heading for a crash.
Which only someone like Hogarth could perhaps depict for us. Adam Bolton, thank you very much for being on the couch.
My pleasure.